I was outside enjoying the Arizona sun and wonderful temperatures. It's always fun to get to be in different parts of the country.
Take some home.
Take some home, yeah.
At least 15 degrees.
At least, I love it. Well, I live in Orlando, Florida, and what we have that you have some of is humidity. And like the other day, I was on my way to the airport to head off somewhere, and the guy said, today's high is going to be 93. And then he said, the real feel, you know what that is? It's the temperature of what it actually feels like based on humidity, is going to be 110. So even though the temperature was 93, it still felt like it was way over 100 degrees. But right now we've been having it pretty cool down there, in relative terms, in the mid-80s, and still it feels like it's 96 because of humidity and all that kind of stuff. So low humidity for us is 78%. You know, not unusual to be in the 90s and all that kind of good stuff. Well, cool. Well, it sounds like you guys were making some good progress as I came in and talking about what you were reflecting on from this morning. And I want to kind of jump us back in to this second G, get the log out of your own eye, into Matthew 7. And I want to give you a setting of what I want to do now for the next few minutes. And it's going to take us a little while, and there's kind of stages to it. And so I'll tell you what they are so that you can know how to pace yourself and so forth. I believe that what we as Christians need to really grapple with is what Jesus and the apostles taught, and how Jesus taught the foundational truth and then the apostle built on it. I think that's what we have in, there's multiple illustrations of this, of course, but it's what we have in Matthew 7, verse 1 through 6, as we'll take a look at here in a few moments. And then what you see James building on out of that in James chapter 3 and 4. Perhaps the whole book of James, but nonetheless, James chapter 3 and 4. So I'm going to use those two texts as the two texts for what we do. Now, the progression of an idol, that's, I think it's page 22 in your participant guide, is the tool, and I'll illustrate that in just a few moments. It's not hard to recognize, you know, I desire, I demand, I expect, you disappoint, I judge, I punish. That's kind of the framing of the six stages of the progression of an idol. But I'm going to use a story out of my life just a few years ago that illustrates how this works, okay? I'll probably give a couple of other stories in church settings as well as relational life that will help you kind of filter through the progression. My hope in that is that you get a handle on how to use the progression of an idol. That's my hope. It's just a very usable tool. That's why we call it a tool. So we'll look at the text, teach the text, we'll talk about the tool, and hopefully learn to use the tool, okay? Recognize it and learn how to use it and what it's there for. So, make sense? Okay. So may I pray for us before we open God's Word and talk about this text? Lord, every time we open your word, we get more amazed at its depth and breadth, the amazing truth that's in it that never seems to stop. The deeper we go, the deeper we realize we could go, not only in what it means and what it says, but in how it works in us and how it transforms us. Thank you for the eternal word of God. Thank you for the powerful sword of the Spirit. Thank you for how you use it to transform us. Lord, as we open it now, I just ask you to give us great care in not only how we dissect it, but how we understand its relationship to the other texts around it, as well as to the other passages that we might identify to glean from and learn from, but then also how it works in us. Lord, take this word and plant it deeply inside of us. A few moments ago, we talked about those two words, Lord Jesus, that you spoke in, in Matthew 7, 5. And they're very clearly direct words. You're trying to get our attention. You're trying to help us see a movement that we need to make, or else we match those two words. And Lord, we don't want to hear "you hypocrite." We want to hear "well done." And so may you take us now to the depth of this word that will empower us to be able to walk in its precepts, to understand how you are doing what you're doing inside of us, even as we look to learn what our log is, as we learn the language of heart idolatry, as we learn how to understand our own heart when we are in conflict. And I pray that in your holy and righteous name, amen. The little video clip, German Coast Guard, that I used a few moments ago as we ended before lunch, was purposed to say you really do have to listen carefully and you might have to think differently, because language can betray us. It can literally deny our ability to get what God is saying. And too many times we go way too fast. And case in point, Matthew 7:1. You ever heard the two verses? Of course you have, right? Judge not. And you don't have to go past that, do you? You go, judge not. It's a prohibitive. He's saying, don't do it. Now, let me ask you a question, and please don't raise your hand. But who would say, I just really obey that verse every day, and every moment of every day, I'm a great non-judger. I mean, none of us would raise our hand, would we? Because honestly, the truth of the matter is, we judge all the time. So I don't think it's a prohibitive of cessation. I don't think he's saying, don't do this, ever. I think he's trying to get our attention. Now, the proof of that to me is verse 2. The way you judge is the way you will be judged. Here comes his intent. He's trying to say to us, be careful. Walk slowly. Understand the purpose of what judgment is to do for you, because you will make judgments. You will. The term that he uses in Matthew 7, 1 and 2 is pronounced in the Greek language, krino. Now, I want you to hear it, because I'm going to add two other words to it. One is katakrino and one is diakrino. Okay? There's more than those two words, but these are two that are representative of how this thing called judgment happens inside our lives and what becomes offensive to God when those judgment takes place, so much so that Jesus would say, don't do it. Now, the other factor to it, the other part to it, is when you take verse 1 and 2 of Matthew 7 and attach it to verse 3, 4, and 5, are they attached? Yes. They're not separated. They shouldn't be separated. Jesus said them in order. He said them in the line of his conversation with us as Christians, with his disciples, saying, I'm trying to say something to you. And verse 1 and 2 is the doorway to understand verse 3, 4, and 5. It's literally the doorway. We shouldn't just separate them apart. And too many times we've done that. We read verse 1 and 2 and we talk about judgment and the problem of judgment. And that's a fair subject to talk about. But we don't attach it immediately to verse 4, 5, and 6. 3, 4, and 5, excuse me. And so, but I think one of the purposes that God has and Christ has in saying verse 1 and 2 is to get us to do what verse 3, 4, and 5 say. He wants us to deal with the judgment piece, and I'm going to pull it apart in just a second and take you down this path of understanding what he's trying to say here. But then to make sure that we don't stop there, but we come back and say, so what does this look like by way of the log and the speck kind of thing? Because now he's getting real practical, isn't he? Because when he says, don't judge, how do I know if you're being judgmental? Well, I don't. How do you know if you're being judgmental? Sometimes I don't know whether I'm being judgmental or not. I don't see something, you know? And it may be the problem with like James 1:16, where he says, do not be deceived. You know what the problem with that is? If I'm deceived, I don't know it. I'm deceived. I mean, what am I deceived about? I don't know. If I know what I'm deceived about, I'm not deceived. I'm making a choice. I'm embracing something, you know? Does that make sense? But when a person is deceived, they're clueless. They don't see it. You know, it's something they don't recognize. And so he's saying, don't be deceived. And he spends the rest of chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3 identifying areas that we are easily deceived in. One right after the other, all the way down to the tongue and all the way down to the heart in chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, and then verse 13 through 20, through 18 of chapter 3 on the heart. All the way through that. And we can be deceived very easily. Make sense? So how do I know that? So what I want to do now is kind of take you through the pathway of what he means by this word judge. The word krino is a word which means distinguish between. That's what it means. It means distinguish between. It's like I understand the difference between a music stand and a stool. That's what it means. I can distinguish between those two things. I know the difference between a man and a woman, a floor and a chair. Distinguish, all it means. In the word itself, in the nature of the word itself, there's no moral implication. None. Right, wrong is non-involved. It's just distinguishing between. The way the writer in the New Testament uses krino, distinguishing between, will tell you whether he's talking about a judgment that's right or a judgment that's evil or whatever it is. It's the usage of the term that gets you to distinguish whether it's a good use of the term judge or a bad use of the term judge. For instance, a good use of the term judge is when you leave here today, if you are driving your car, I hope that you will krino all the way home and do it really well. Know when to stop and know when to turn and know, you know, don't run over the guy in front of you, you know, distinguish. Does that make sense? So, when Jesus is saying, don't judge, he's trying to get our attention not to stop something completely, but to understand what the effect of judging has to us. Like when I just krino, I can walk down this aisle because I'm distinguishing the aisle from the chairs. It gives me a way to move, a way to move forward. Does that make sense? So when he says in verse 2, the way you krino, the way you judge, is the way you will be judged. Now, he's promising you something. He's predicting your future based on how you judge, on what you do with this krino thing. You take something good and make it bad. You're going to get that in your life. You're going to get that as a result. The way you judge is the way you will be judged. It's going to come that way. Does that make sense? So Jesus is being very specific here. And he's being very specific, not just about, and I'm going to use another term now that has this negative tone or negative connotation of judgment on it. It's not just about condemning, condemnation. He's not saying don't condemn in this verse. He's saying don't judge. Pure and simple. The word condemn, like in Romans chapter 2, verse 1 and following, Paul uses the word condemn. And he says in Romans 2, 1, when you condemn someone else, you condemn yourself, for you do the same things. That's what verse 1 of Romans 2 says. When you judge your brother, you judge yourself, for you do the same things. Here's that mirror again. Remember the mirror? Here's that mirror again. What you see in a brother or in a sister is reflective of you, and in particular of your heart. The word judge or condemn, depending on the translation, in Romans 1 is kata krino. Here's what it means. It means to judge against. He just takes the preposition against, kata, and puts it and adds it to krino, kata krino. I'm distinguishing between, but my distinguishing between these two things, I am using against you. I am going to cause you to fall. I am going to hurt you. I am going to use what I am distinguishing between as the truth, or as falsehood. I can take it negatively. And I'm going to use it against you. I intend to harm you. I intend to hurt you. I am condemning towards you. I'm demeaning to you personally. I'm putting you down. All those kinds of things. That's judge. That's condemn. That's the word Paul is using in this verse. Make sense so far? Okay? And he's saying, don't ever do that. That is a command of cessation. He is saying, don't judge against. Now, when we get in conflict with someone, it's really easy to all of a sudden be against them, to see them as our enemy. And many times we use the word opponent And we don't really mean to be setting up the conflict between the person. We mean to be distinguishing that I have a difference with this other person. And I am in an oppositional standpoint with them, which indicates that I'm judging against. Make sense? Condemnation, katakrino, judging against a person is never okay. Ever. Now, do you have to distinguish between things? Yes. And here comes diakrino. Okay? Dia is the word through. Like I'm walking through these two aisles of chairs. Right? I'm walking through it. Through judgment. Now, I'm no longer using what I know against you. Now, I'm using what I know to walk alongside of you, to walk through it. I'm walking through it with you. We translate this word more than one way, but the positive translation word is the word discernment. When I discern, I am diakrinoing. I'm not using the knowledge that I have or my view of what you've done, and I may be absolutely right. You are a bold-faced, sinning... I wasn't going to add anything else after that, but I don't know if you were or not. But, you know, I may be totally right, but now I'm not using it against you. I'm not putting it up to say, you're done, you're dead, you're gone. No. I'm not using it to separate. I'm not using it for those purposes. That's katakrino. That's condemnation. I'm to never do that. I'm using it to assist us. I'm going to walk through that krino, those judgments, those distinguishing of what is true and what is different. I'm going to walk through that with you in order to get somewhere. Now, to fast forward, I won't talk about this more right now. I'll talk about it a little bit later today. But to fast forward, it's Galatians chapter 6. You know, when we see someone caught in a sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a one. It's the third G, gentle restoration, okay, to gently restore. We are to restore that person. So what I see in you might be true. What I'm distinguishing in you might be real. But what I do with that is the difference between whether it's condemning and prohibited by God or whether it's discernment and something that I'm actually can and you should use with you because I know what I know. I see what I see. I see this and it's real. You may not see it. You may be deceived. You may be blind. You may be denial. You know, you may be escaping your way past it, but I see it and it's real and you need help. Make sense? You with me? So this is where...
English versions make sense to me.
So I'm sorry?
The English versions make sense to me. The katakrino, the other, mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. You get the English, you're good.
Okay.
Good,
yeah.
Yes. Okay. You see, the problem is when God is saying katakrino and he uses the word judge, and he uses krino and he uses the word judge, they mean different things. And we need to distinguish those meanings. That's the point, okay? That's why the word judge, condemn, discern, those three English words are helpful to us. But too many times the word judge will be used in the New Testament, and it could be any one of the three of those words, any one of the three of them. So you have to be careful. So part of what I'm trying to say here is, in Matthew 7:1, Jesus is saying don't condemn people. He's not saying don't condemn people. That would be katakrino. He is saying don't judge. That's what he's saying. Do not judge lest you be judged. That's what he's saying. Don't krino. Because you have to do something with krino. You're either going to be against or you're going to be assisting. Is that making sense? Now, what does that mean to me? Listen now. I mean, please help. Let me make sure I'm on the same page with you. He doesn't say verse 1 and 2, in order for me to become this benign person who never sees anything, who just escapes through the life, who's a doormat when someone else is doing something wrong. Don't judge them. I mean, that's how it gets played in a lot of Christian circles. He's not saying that. He's saying that because your judgments are an indicator of your heart. Now, look at verses 3, 4, and 5. I'm in a Bible code. And I want you just to notice this because these things are connected. They're not disconnected. And I think if we disconnect them, we're making a mistake. You know? So in verse 3, he starts asking questions now. Now, clearly, he's not changing the subject. Now he's applying the subject, clearly. He's spoken the truth. Don't judge. He's spoken the truth. The way you judge is the way you will be judged. And now he's going to apply. And he says, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Clearly, he's trying to get me to think about me. He's trying to get me to think about my heart. He's not just trying to get me to say, okay, because I see something, that becomes the subject. I see something in you. Now, my subject, my first subject is to talk about you. Look at the next verse, and you'll see it say it again. Or, he asks again, how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? I mean, he's clearly trying to do a contrast here, isn't he? Now, why do you see the speck in your brother's eye? Because it's there. Okay, let's assume that for a moment. It's not. He's not saying you don't see what you see. He's not saying that at all. And quite frankly, verse 5 proves that. But he's not saying that at all. What he is saying is don't look at the speck and not notice the log. Now, I'll give you my... Here's this reflector thing. This is how I view this. Okay, so just take it for what it's worth or consider it. I would say consider it. To see the speck is to have the log. To see the speck is to have the log. It's a reflector. Every time I look and make a judgment, don't do it. Every time I look and make a judgment, I'm seeing a reflection of me. And I'll read Romans 2:1 for you now. And some of you may have already turned to it and taken a look at it. But let me just read it so it's in the tape as well. Paul says, therefore, verse 1, Romans 2, you have no excuse, every one of you who passes judgment. For in that which you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same thing. It's a reflector. Verse 5 of Romans 7 demonstrates it again. Look, you hypocrite, first, priority, first, by way of importance, first, take the log out of your own eye. When I see the speck in my brother, my assignment is to discover the log in me. It's not to go change him or correct him. This is where we believe pause has to take place. In conflict resolution, to where I'm committed to glorifying God, first G. I'm just committed to utterly glorifying God with all of my heart. And I look at my brother and I see the speck and I know what's wrong and I want it corrected and I want it dealt with because it hurts me or whatever the motivation is. I want that. And Jesus is saying, slow down. Don't go try to fix him until you understand what your log is. You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly. You can underline those words. Then you will see clearly. Now, two things. If I don't know what my log is, I don't see clearly. Then you will see clearly. First, take the log out of your own eye. If I can't identify my log, I don't see clearly. If I can't identify my log and actually start working on my log, I won't see clearly. Then you will see clearly to get the speck out of your brother's eye. It's not that the speck isn't there, and it's not that you're not to help retract the speck out of his eye. You are. You have an assignment when you see sin or a problem in another person's life. You need to help them, but please don't do it until you've looked at yourself, until you've understood what your log is.
Is there really no speck and no log? It's just issues?
The speck-log thing is a metaphor. It's just a signal.
That's what I thought. Okay.
And it can be issues, it can be sin, it can be offenses, it can be hurts, it can be all kinds of, it can be attitudes or actions. Yes.
Okay. I get it. Correct me if I'm wrong. But
it's okay.
It sounds to me like it's a good reason to pause is you have to purify your own heart and identify where your heart is before you proceed, because your heart, you might want to benefit them, but part of it might be vengeance and part of it might be retaliation because you've been hurt, and you have to purify your own intent and make sure that you don't proceed in a way that's vengeful and angry towards them.
I agree with that. I think you do have to be careful. You have to slow down. purify your heart. That's a statement in Scripture, isn't it? I mean, God actually says that to us. I don't think he says that because we have the ability to purify our heart. I think he says that because we need to get on the path of how heart purity is completed and takes place. Heart purity only comes to Christ, and only comes through the blood of Christ, and only comes through biblical means. Biblical means are what's going to transform me, nothing less than that. So it's not like me pulling myself up by my bootstraps, getting my right thinking cap on before I go confront my brother about what the speck is. You know, it's not just that. No, it's me really dealing inside. I mean, there are times, just as an illustration, there are times when I'm really upset with someone and God slows me down and he wants me to deal with my own heart. And I deal with my heart, I discover my log, and when I get out of discovering my log, I realize I can overlook the speck that I saw. I don't even have to go talk to the person. It's overlookable. Now, before that, I wouldn't have seen it as overlookable. I would have seen it as totally offensive. It's not something that could be overlooking, and no transaction but forgiveness could be granted. But now it is. I see differently. Now I see clearly. Before, I didn't see clearly. That's one of the reasons when someone approaches us and they're talking to us something that we just think is trivial, and maybe, and let's just assume for argument and for this conversation that it is trivial, but they're approaching us like it's not trivial, and they're trying to nail us to the wall, is a phrase I've used. They're trying to nail us to the wall over this simple thing. We go, okay, what else do you want me to do? I've already said I'm sorry. I've already said I've tried to own it. You know, it's really simple. If they had gotten their log out of their eye, maybe they would see this differently, see more clearly, and know that it's overlookable then. And it doesn't have to be the means by way of helping that person retract that speck out of their eye isn't as severe as they're actually using. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it just calls to mind an incident in the library where this guy was mad at this kid next to him because he chuckled while he was on the phone, while he was on the computer. And this guy, it starts attacking him and actually getting really angry. And the kid's, apologizing, and he's still angry. And he's disrupting everybody around him, which is exactly what he was complaining about the kid doing. I mean,
Right. Okay. So here's my point now. Hang on. That's right. Deal with yourself first. Here's my point. When you see the speck, it's an assignment to understand what your heart looks like. Get the log out of your own eye. As a matter of fact, when you add verse 6 to this argument, and many times verse 6 is taken totally out of context of Matthew 7. I don't think it should be. I think it's aligned here. How do I give the truth to another person? It's this verse about pearls before swine, you know. quite frankly, hang on, let me talk, okay? Quite frankly, there's this problem that we have when we give someone something they're not ready to receive. That's what he's talking about. The clarity of knowing when to talk to the person about their speck comes as I have discovered my log, as I understand my contribution to the conflict, as it would be said in the materials, you know, on the front page of this second G. How have I contributed to this conflict? As I understand that, it helps me know how to deliver the truth to the person. Many times conflicts get worse because the person is prematurely saying what they're saying to the other person. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be said. It doesn't mean it's not true and the person needs to hear it. It's just premature delivery. They're getting there before the person is ready to hear. Let him who has ears to hear. Okay? Is the person ready to hear? Throwing a pearl before a swine means I'm giving them a truth that they're not prepared to listen to. They're not prepared to accept. And many times we think we're just righteous. And it's self-righteousness, of course. But we end up thinking we're right and we're righteous because we delivered the truth to this person, and dadgummit, they wouldn't listen. And what we find in our work is many times that person has not done second G work and they're making a mess of it because they haven't looked at their own stuff. They haven't looked at their own contribution. They haven't looked at their heart. If I were to say, what is your log? They could not tell me. Now, to put it into new language, maybe, this is that shift, you know, German Coast Guard. This is that shift. To put it in new language, what is your heart idolatry? How and what are you serving? How and what are you fearing? How and what are you craving, wanting? In whom and how are you trusting? How does this trusting God, in your absolute trusting God, how is it demonstrated in your approach to that other person? Or are you really trusting in yourself? Or are you hopeless, as many people are? Are you hopeless in this relationship, in this situation with this person? Okay, I'll tell them what I think they ought to hear, but I have no hope at all that they're going to listen. You're hopeless. Instead of walking into it saying, no, I'm armed with the gospel. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. They will change. They will hear. The Holy Spirit will convict. And having that kind of faith, that kind of recognition that the gospel is effective in Christian living and in dealing with conflict. God used it in dealing with conflict with us. We should use it in dealing with conflict with each other. And to absolutely having faith like that. Now, to knowing it can be a path and it can be a journey and there's different elements to it, all that's fair. And I can build out what those elements are, like the difference between forgiveness and trust, for example. I won't do that right now just because of time. But those are definable. And they are, and they're able to be recognizable so that you know how to apply what you need to apply at that moment. Do I need to be working on trust development with this person, or do I need to be working on forgiveness with this person is an example of that. Okay? And so here's this opportunity. And I think what Jesus is trying to say in Matthew 7 is you got to slow way, way down right now. You got to pause. You got to listen to your own heart. You got to understand what it looks like and what it's about. Now, in James chapter 3 and 4, that's what James is applying. I believe he's taking what Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 6 teaches, and he's applying it into relational life. That's what he's doing. And when he comes out of, boy, it's a trail to get to chapter 3 now, but when he comes out of chapter 1, 2, and 3, and gets into the end of this, he starts talking about motivating factors. That's another frame or another way to describe log. What's motivating me? It's another way to describe heart idolatry. What is my idol? What am I motivated by? Is it something good or is it something bad? You with me? Which one is it? Because I can be motivated by something evil, like revenge. You know, I can be revengeful. That's clearly not good. No, I'm actually going to mention that tomorrow morning in my message, and so I won't mention it right now. Okay? But I can also be motivated by something good. Now, I want to tell you a story now that happened to me a few years ago with a guy named Thomas. And this is going to illustrate the log process and how I identify heart idolatry. It's going to introduce the opportunity to take the progression of an idol and learn how to apply it when I'm in the middle of a conflict with someone. You with me? Okay, so I'm trying to use this as a bridge between these two things, between the text of Scripture and the tool. Progression of an idol, and then how do you get committed to first getting a log out of your own eye? What does that look like? So that you can help the other person get the speck out of their own eye. Okay. I introduced myself a little bit to you earlier this morning, and one of the things I described was this transition from local pastoral ministry to doing what I do now, and how God took me down that path. In the midst of this, I realized that the church that I had planted, I ended up staying there 14 years. The church that I had planted was, can I say it? It was mine. Do you hear heart idolatry already? You should. You know, I really had to own it, you know, and I felt like I had to own it. As a matter of fact, some people would say, one lady, this is just totally, not knowing any of this I'm going to tell you. She had no idea of any of this I'm going to tell you. Wonderful, wonderful lady. She was our preschool, one of our preschool teachers. She led more children to Christ than any human being I know that walks planet Earth. If you put your child into her class, they're going to come out the other end as a believing, faithful Christian, as young as they are. It's just amazing. I'm walking over to go to the auditorium from the offices, and she just calls across the parking lot, "Don't leave us." I mean, this ownership was real. It was real not just with me, but with them. I was so identified because I planted the church as what this church was and who this church was, because it was about how I did what I did. I mean, I was so identified with it that if I left, it would mean death. You know, I mean, you know, you hear idolatry in that? Yeah, you should. Okay. So that's the context now. Now, I come out of this going, okay, don't want to be idolatrous about this, God. Don't want to have my hands on this so much that I can't let go, first of all, and I can't hand off, you know, this church. I want to do it well. I certainly don't want the church to fail after I spent 14 years of my life pouring myself into it. I don't want that to happen, you know. Here comes this, I mean, huge, huge issues inside, you know. So I'm dealing with all that. Quite frankly, I think I dealt with them pretty well. Dealt with them in community and all that kind of stuff. But we came out of that, and I came out of that very much believing, before anyone else did, that it was time for me to transition, which means someone else had to be the senior pastor of this church. Who's the baton going to get handed to? And so we built a profile of what this person should look like or could look like. And there was certainly a version of it in a seasoned guy, and there was a version of it in a young guy. No experience, you know, young. Solid, of course, but you know, young like that. So we had done that. We were praying and looking, and we weren't looking by way of searching. It wasn't like that at that juncture. But we were looking to say, so how does this happen? So fast forward again. I'm in the office one day, and a young man walks in. His name is Thomas. He knocks on the door, and he basically says, let me just give you my story, tell you who I am. And he had been in youth ministry, and he was 29 at this time, young. He was less experienced than experienced. But he said, you know, I've had such challenges in ministry. What I recognize that I need is a mentor. I need someone to disciple me. I'm not looking for a job. I'm not asking for anything. Will you just kind of pour your life into me? Well, I don't know about you, but that makes my blood pump. You know, I mean, I get excited. This guy is real. And I had no thought about this position, none at all. As a matter of fact, we started working together, and about at month three of doing this and just kind of assisting and walking alongside, I could tell you the whole family story. It's a really cool story in his family and all that kind of stuff. But just as I'm sitting there one day, I never will forget it. I'm sitting there in the conference room, and I go, he matches this profile. I hadn't even thought about it. I mean, he's got the characteristics. He's got the passion. He's got the giftedness. He's got the abilities. I mean, all that stuff was there. Now, it's there in a raw form because he's young and he's not experienced and all that kind of stuff. I got all that. And I just go, wow. I go, so I started praying about that. Fast forward again. So I just said to him, you know, do you know that I'm in the process of transitioning and that kind of stuff, and we're looking for this guy? Would you be interested in even thinking about that? And he said no, by the way. He says, that's not why I'm here. I said, I know. I said, I'm not even trying to get you to do anything or get you a job, anything like that. It's not like that. I understand why you're here, and I really don't want that to get lost in this. But would you pray with me about it? He says, okay, I'll pray about it. You know. So we started praying about it. And I ended up adding him, fast forward again, I ended up adding him to the staff, and he came on staff, and he came on with the purpose was to spend 2 years and to experience him in every area of the church, every relationship in the church, so that he understood every type of ministry the church had and every type of leadership, you know, responsibilities, the criteria for leadership in that area. He understood those things, and he knew our people. That was the goal. And to test it. It wasn't like he's going to be the guy right now. It was going to be, let's put him through this process so we can see, is he the guy? We had this privilege of doing it, and honestly, the church didn't have a clue. It wasn't like that, you know, but the leadership understood, and we knew, and we were engaged in this, and so we started that process. Now fast forward 2 more years, okay? 2 years in this process, we're down to the point, and I call it handing the baton off, okay? It's still between me and him. He's still dealing with is this, I mean, because he needed some education, he needed a whole bunch of things, and he knew that. And are we going to hand the baton off or not? Now, I want to make sure that you understand, handing the baton didn't mean he would be senior pastor the next day. Handing the baton meant there's 2 more years. 2 more years before that could even happen. But is he going to go there? You know, that was the point. So we were at a coffee shop, and I handed the baton. It was Thursday. I handed the baton to Thomas, and Thomas took the baton. And I go, wow, that's great, man. It feels so good, you know, because we're making progress. Still got this other path to go and all that kind of stuff. Monday, same coffee shop. I'm sitting with our finance director. Her name is Jen, and we're working through all the stuff we have to work through. And we're sitting there talking about the nature of this stuff, and she alerts me to something about Thomas. I'm going, what? And she keeps, and she tells me some more and some more. And it gets more alarming to me. I mean, worse. And I'm sitting there, and my phone is sitting right here. And I'm listening to her, and I pick up the phone, dial Thomas's number. I get his voicemail. I said, "Thomas, man, call me. We got a problem. We got to talk now. Call me." Bye. Hung up, went back to the conversation. Jen continued in the conversation. As she continued telling me the things that she was telling me, I got more and more alarmed, you know, more and more sensitive, more and more interested in this phone call. Thomas didn't call me back. We end our meeting and go on through the rest of the day. That afternoon, I said, "I don't know why he's not calling me back. I'll email him." Got email. Email him, "Thomas, did you get my phone call? We got a problem. Call me." Send. No reply. Got home that afternoon. No response from Thomas. I get it. He's 30. Texting. Instant messaging. He'll get it. He'll reply right now. And so I texted him. No reply. 3 times I tried to communicate with him. No response at all. Next morning, walk into the office. Say, "Hey, Jen, have you seen Thomas?" "No." I said, "What's going on? I'm communicating 3 times yesterday. No response. Would you call Thomas and just find out? I mean, have you seen him?" "No." "Would you call Thomas and just find out, you know, can he call me back?" I said, "By the way, if we need to mediate this, you tell me where, give me my assignment, my preparation assignment, and I'll be there." Jen was a trained conciliator, and she had the goods and all that kind of stuff. And so, later that day, it's Wednesday, later that day, it's Tuesday, I'm sorry. Later that day, she calls me, and she said, "The mediation's going to be at 1 o'clock on Thursday in the conference room. Be there. Here's your assignment." I went, "Okay, guess Thomas is not calling me back." What is that about? I don't know. So I took the preparation assignment, did the preparation assignment, showed up for the mediation. In the mediation, there was several interesting things. I'm going to get to the core interesting thing. I'd love to talk about all the other stuff and that kind of thing. But in the mediation, I'm sitting there going, "Thomas, why didn't you call me back?" You know? Now, that's an aggressive question. That is a wall-building question. Why didn't you call me back? Don't you understand? I'm your boss. You call me your mentor. That was in that question. You with me? I had that question in my heart. Now, by the way, we dealt with the thing Jen brought up, and Thomas responded to that just beautifully. We rectified it. It wasn't as bad as she thought or as it sounded. And we were able to resolve it and resolve it pretty quickly. But now I'm sitting there going, "I just handed you the baton and you're not communicating with me." Now that's not okay. And even though my heart was engaged, it's not okay. And so I'm saying, "Why didn't you call me back?" And here's what Thomas said to me. Thomas said, "Paul, you scared me. I was afraid to call you back. I have never heard the tone in your voice that I heard in that voicemail. And when the email and the text came, they were louder. I was afraid to call you back." And then he said the key sentence for me. "You were harsh." Harsh. And I had to own that. Because that was me talking. I mean, I know it's a reflector. Remember? I know that. And I said to Thomas, "I never want you to experience harshness at my hands. What can we do to gain forgiveness and rectify this?" And we did. And it was wonderful. I mean, it was pure, you know. And at 5 o'clock, we walked out of the conference room, settled. Both issues settled. I mean, really wonderful. I mean, amazing. I needed the help. Thomas needed the help. I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't had Jen there to actually assist us through that process. I mean, honestly, I don't know what would happen. You with me? So, I owned my own stuff. I confessed my sin. And I went home that night. And I said to God, here comes Matthew 7. You read? Okay. "Lord, what in my heart allowed me to treat my brother with harshness? What is the idol? What is the motivating factor here? Not just the behavior. That was fair, and that was right, and I needed to own it. Because he experienced harshness at my hands. Did I intend to be harsh? No. Was I harsh? Yes. I can give you a whole history of why. I mean, this isn't the first time I've heard it. You with me? This is challenging waters for me. But now I'm saying, God, I can't stop there. I've got to penetrate to the log. I've got to get to the heart idolatry. And so that night I began praying. And by Sunday morning, I felt like the Lord had revealed to me what my heart idol was. I won't tell you what it is in just a second. Because you're not done just by saying, will you forgive me for my behavior or for what I did or didn't do? You're not done then. If you think you're done then, you're missing the point. You're not getting to the log. And if you don't get to the log, it's hypocritical. It's hypocritical for me to say, Thomas, I got a problem with you. Come in and talk. And for me to instruct Jen, if it takes a mediation, get him in the room. It's hypocritical for me to do that if I'm not willing to look at my own heart. If I'm not willing to really learn what's inside and what motivated that. Because that's what it's about. And it's judgment. It's literally judgment against. It is condemnation if I fail to do that. That's what Jesus is trying to say in Matthew 7. Don't judge. Get to the heart. Understand your log. That's the point of the judgment. Why does judgment happen for us and in us? It says it's a signal that there's a log underneath that I need to dive to. And I need to understand what it is. You with me? Now, some logs are evil, like the revenge thing. Some logs are bad. And those are easy to repent of or to recognize, I need to change that. I want harm to that person. That's satanic. That's like the enemy. It's not like Jesus. Jesus doesn't want harm to anybody. He wants them saved. Read John 3:17. I mean, that's why he came into the world. You with me? So if it's evil, I mean, it's clearly repentable and it's clearly something I need to deal with. But I didn't have an evil motive. I didn't have an evil heart idolatry. But I did have heart idolatry. And I want to tell you what it was. It was a good thing. It's called personal responsibility. Personal responsibility. If you're going to be the pastor of this church, you are going to have to be personally responsible. If you're not personally responsible, if you don't think I can take the baton back, you misunderstand this whole process. Because I can take it back, buddy. You with me? You hearing it? Are you hearing it? Now think about progression of an idol. Look at page 22, 23, 23, 24. And just look at that progression and just listen. And I'll identify it as we go along here. Because the progression of an idol is clearly there. I wanted something. I want Thomas to be personally responsible. I demanded Thomas be personally responsible. I expected. Are you kidding me? I expected him to be personally responsible. He disappointed me. This was emotional. It was not okay. He disappointed me. And I judged him. I judged him. And I judged him when he didn't call me back. And punishment? Oh, the punishment's coming. You're going to have to rectify this, buddy. And if you don't, I will take the baton back. And I thought about it. I will take it back. Don't care what it does to you, crush you. I mean, you've gone a long way to get to the point to where you think you're going to be senior pastor and you're going to have this opportunity to really minister and to do these things that, you know, we've talked about and dreamed about and discipled toward and all of the envisioned, all of those things. We've done every one of those things. I'll take it back. You think that wasn't punishment? You see it? But see, that's the point. If you don't dive and understand the heart idolatry, you're missing it. You're missing the opportunity of what Christ is saying in Matthew 7 that he wants you to get to. Not just turn away from bitter jealousy like one of the James 3 heart idols that he talks about, or envy, the other that he talks about. It's not just those evil ones. We think many times that heart idolatry is just something bad, and we say, I intended good. And we're missing the point. Doesn't matter if you intended good. Doesn't matter at all. Because you can use a good thing for a bad reason. Or you can use a good thing in a bad way. One theologian said, it's not that we want something that's harmful, it's how badly we want it that's harmful. I wanted Thomas to be personally responsible. And quite frankly, this is innate within me. It's because my father, as I told you earlier, abandoned us when I was 7. My mom raised us by herself, and there was 7 of us. And she did a phenomenal job. When he left us, she had no driver's license, had never worked a day in her life. She had been having babies and growing babies and all those wonderful things that mothers do. I mean, a huge job, but nothing that made money, nothing that could cause livelihood to happen. And she had to change. She had to take responsibility and go do it. This was built inside of me. I watched her do this for years. Wonderful Christian lady. I mean, phenomenal. I'll tell you a little bit about her tomorrow morning in my message. I mean, it's amazing. And this was innate within me. And I'm saying, you will be personally responsible. That was a demand. When a desire is elevated to the level of a demand, an idol is talking. When I want something and I make it a requirement, it's idolatry. When I desire and elevate it to the level of a demand, my heart is engaged. It's idolatry. And just to demonstrate this, okay? I know this, by the way. Why couldn't I have listened to Jen's whole story? Remember, I picked up the phone, called him, set it down, and she continued in conversation. As a matter of fact, she kept talking the whole time I was telling him, we have a problem, call me now. She didn't stop. I didn't wait. I didn't go slow at all. I went way too fast. That was one. Secondly, do I really think that Thomas doesn't have the quality of personal responsibility when I just handed him the baton? I have just elevated this desire that he has as well, but to a level of a demand. Why didn't I, when I know this skill really well, why didn't I turn the statement into a question? And instead of saying, you will be personally responsible or punishment, and instead of that, just sit down and say, Thomas, will you be personally responsible to respond to this issue that Jen is bringing to our attention? Will you do it? It was a substantive issue, by the way, and if it had gone unchecked in his life, it could have ruined his ministry. It was real. It wasn't just fictitious. It was real. I've watched men be destroyed over this same thing, and I don't want that to happen to Thomas, but I don't want, you see? And I don't want turned to, you will not. That's idolatry. I'm playing God. Judgment is playing God.
So you're saying you were wrong?
I was definitely wrong.
Oh, thank you. I was getting so upset with you.
Oh, I'm good.
She thinks you're perfect.
You are a precious lady. No, she was getting mad at me, boy. I love it. Well, look. I came to this conclusion that this was idolatry on Saturday, and so I called Thomas. He answered his phone and said, hey, Thomas, it's Paul. He said, hey, good to hear you. You know, he wasn't scared anymore. I was really grateful for that. And I said, you know, I've learned something since Thursday. Will you have breakfast with me tomorrow morning before services so I can tell you what I've learned? Because it's good. And I have something else I need to ask of you. And he said, yes. So the next morning, we met at that same coffee shop, at the same table Jen and I were meeting at, by the way. I loved that table. And I said, Thomas, let me tell you what God did for me. I said, I need to thank you. Because if you had kowtowed to me and just called me back and said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, I would not know what I know right now about my heart. But you didn't. Thank you for not calling me back. Because I asked the Lord, why was this able to be in me? Why could I treat you this way? And he showed me my heart idolatry. And I asked you to forgive me on Thursday, and you did. I'm not asking you for forgiveness for that. I don't need to do that. But what I'm asking you to forgive me for now is serving an idol at your expense. I sacrificed you on the altar of my idol. Every idol demands sacrifice. Every one of them. And I sacrificed you on my idol, my altar, at my idol of personal responsibility. I mean, I know you're personally responsible, but I acted as if you weren't. And why didn't I just simply ask you, will you be personally responsible? Because you have to keep being personally responsible if you're going to be a leader in the church. You can't just say, I've been personally responsible, I'm not going to be next week or in the future. That's not acceptable. So, but why didn't I just ask? Why wasn't it a conversation instead of a demand? You see, the progression of an idol served me so well. I sat down that Thursday and Saturday and Friday and said, Lord, what did I want? I turned I desire into a question. What did I want? My wife and I were having a conversation one day, and I was really confused, quite frankly, and walking going, man, I just don't know what to do. You get a signal that this is happening in my home. walking away going, I don't know what to do with this, you know. And so we paused, because we understand this principle. We paused in order to look at our heart, and I walked away from it, and I said, Lord, what do I want? I wrote down 2.5 pages of things that I wanted. Can you see why Meg and I were having a challenge at that moment? Because I wanted a lot. to think that that list didn't end up becoming I expect is misunderstanding it. To think that 2.5 pages of desires doesn't translate into some level of demand is misunderstanding it. Who's going to match up to 2.5 pages of desires? Disappointment. You getting a connection with this progression of an idol? It serves you so well. Because then I walked away from what I want to how did I make this a demand? How did she experience this as a demand? And by the way, one of the best ways that you can learn what your idolatry is to ask the person, what do you think I want? And then, how have you experienced my desire? Did you experience it as a demand? Did you see it as me requiring something of you? Or was it really a desire and not more than a desire? What causes, James 4:1, the quarrels and conflicts among you? Is it not the desires within you? You want something, you don't get it, so you fight and you quarrel. Every conflict starts with what I want. It starts with my desire. If you're not asking the question, what is it that I want? You're making a fundamental error. And then if you're not learning from the person you're in conflict with, how have you experienced my desire? And find out just how demanding have you been? Because we don't always know. You with me? We don't know. But when I'm open to that other person saying, look, I know you want that, but you want it too much. You want it at my expense. You want it and you want it for me. And my wife has said to me multiple times, I don't want that. So I want something she doesn't. What do you do with that? Just demand? That's idolatry. That's what we're saying. Expectations and disappointments demonstrate demand. Expectation and disappointments make up what demand is. Demand isn't just saying you will or you must. It can be attitudinal. You don't say anything, but you're totally disappointed in that person because they didn't meet up to your expectations. That's idolatry. That's the log. You with me? That's the log. You hypocrite, first get the log out of your own eye. I mean, how do you do that? And see, until James comes along and adds this language to us to talk about these motivating factors like envy and bitter jealousy, those kind of things. And he talks about wisdom in that text in James 3, doesn't he? He identifies three kinds of wisdom that's real natural to this world. He talks about the wisdom of men, the natural wisdom, the wisdom that's within inside of us, and the wisdom of the world, and then the wisdom of the devil, the demonic. You know, he names all three. But then in verse 17 he says, but the wisdom which comes from above is first of all pure. What's the second quality of the wisdom that comes from above? Do you know? First of all pure, then peaceable. It's peacemaking. It's peaceful. And see, when I'm in an argument with a person and I am not peaceful, I am not peaceable, I'm not trying to rectify this, I'm idolatrous. That's what he's saying. So what causes the quarrels and conflicts among you? Verse 1, chapter 4. It's what you want. You can trace from what you want in this argument, in this conflict, from what you want all the way down to how you punish that person. Thomas was scared.
God bless you.
I was harsh. He experienced it at my hands. It's idolatry. It's the log. You getting it? You catching it? It's how you discover what the log is. If you don't discover what the log is, if you're not willing to discover what the log is, you got to deal with Jesus in Matthew 7, 5 and the first two words of the verse. You hypocrite. It's hypocritical for you to look at my speck and try to get my speck out of me and you haven't dealt with your log. You got to pause and deal with your log, friends. Listen, this slows down conflict resolution. We know that. But it's fair to slow down conflict resolution. It doesn't have to be resolved real fast. Doesn't have to be. You with me? Sometimes it might take you, I mean, it took me 3 days in that one setting just to discover that one thing. Sometimes it might take you a long time. I'm dealing with one right now that has to do with my wife and I. I'm dealing with one right now that I've been in the process of trying to figure this out and working through this progression and understanding my own idolatry. And it's probably, I don't know, 3 years, maybe not three. It's long. Now we're life partners, you know. I mean, we're committed to the day we're dead, you know. It's not like this has to be done tomorrow. You know, we're working through this. We're going to walk through it together. She knows. I mean, we're engaged. It's not like we're silent. You don't have to be silent in the middle of the pause, but you have to be focused on what your log is. Now, just suppose what happened. This is culture development now. Okay, you with me? Culture for you as a community. What would happen if you and the other person you're in conflict were to both pause at the same time and both look at your own log at the same time? Pray for each other to discover the log. Encourage each other to discover the log. Stay away from the conflict. Stay away from the argument while you're discovering the log. Don't try to point it out in the other person's life. Let God do that. Who's God here? Trust the Lord that He's going to work in that person's life. And as you honestly engage the Word of God to think that the Scripture isn't going to have its transforming work in you is unbelief. But if you believe it has a transforming work and you can get the other person as well as yourself to say, hey, we really got a problem. We need to discover what logs are. You know, we need to go on a log hunt. You know what we end up doing? We actually have people do this at times. I don't do it a lot, but I got a friend in Denver. Her name is Candy McCune. She's an attorney there and wonderful, wonderful lady. I've worked with her in several different settings and mediation settings. And when she gives homework to the people, she says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to list two things, your logs and the other person's specs. Now, can you imagine which list is longer? You know, they come out with two or three things on logs and 15 on specs. It's almost always like that. Does that give you an indication of something? You see, they're not looking honestly at their own stuff. They're focused over there. And if you stay focused on, and I'm not saying don't be focused on the other person. Remember verse 5? Then you will see clearly to get the speck out of your brother's eye. You have an assignment to get the speck out of your brother's eye. But not until you've gotten the log out of yours. If you go digging in their eye with your scalpel, when you don't see clearly, guess what the result's going to be? Blind mess. That's one of the reasons why conflict explodes and gets worse before it gets better when people don't follow the biblical pattern that Jesus has given us. But if you'll slow down and pause, I'm telling you, it's amazing what happens when a person understands their own heart idolatry. I mean, Thomas, I'll just give you one story about Thomas and I. After we had transferred and he was in the seat and I was gone. I was doing this work. I was in an airport somewhere. I think it was Minnesota. I don't remember exactly, but I was in the airport waiting on a flight, and then my phone rang, and I looked down, and I see Thomas's name, and I smile. You know, I go, oh, man, cool. Picked up and talked to Thomas. And here's what Thomas said. He said, Paul, my younger brother was just in an accident, and he's in a coma. And my mom and my brother's fiance are fighting over who has the rights to say what happens to him. Now, the hospital did some things that were really weird, by the way, in my opinion, that exacerbated the problem. Then he said, I know I am to be a peacemaker with my mom and my brother's fiance. What do I do next? At this tender time in Thomas's life, when his brother is lying in a coma and his mom and his fiance are fighting, he's calling me to help him and to be a brother in Christ and walk through that with him. What a privilege. Do you think if I had not done what we experienced together, understood my law, do you think we would have ever gotten to that level of opportunity to pour life into each other, to love each other, and to minister to each other? No, we wouldn't. And we continue to do that. My wife and his wife are really good friends. She's a DJ at the, it's kind of like that Love, whatever it's called here, K-Love, something like that. She's a DJ at Z88.3 in Orlando, and really well known in the community and all that kind of stuff. But they just love each other. They're just really, you know, partners. You think we would have those kind of benefits, those kind of relationships, if Thomas and I had imploded? If I'd have said, give me the baton back. If I'd have said, you're a jerk, or, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, it wouldn't have happened, you know? The opportunity of ministry, I call it the silencing of the gospel. The silencing of the gospel would happen. My voice to Thomas that day, and we spent 45 minutes on the phone and just talked about what he could think about and how he could approach his mom, how he could approach his sister-in-law, or not quite yet, she was a fiancé, and how he could deal with his own heart when he's going to go. He's about to fly to see into Michigan. He's about to fly up to Michigan to see these folks, and he's going to walk into this room and see his brother laying there in a coma for the first time. I mean, wow. And I had the privilege of ministering to him. I mean, man, that just warms me. Do you see it? See, we miss so much. And the opportunity of what life and what community ought to produce, how Christian living ought to be lived out, is lost because we just don't look at our own heart. And we let the conflict exacerbate. We escape our way past it. We're going all the way back to the first G. We don't go up the slope and move up the slope and have the discussion. We deny it. We escape. We run. We say the person's not going to listen. Who cares? And that probably means I don't care. Wow. God can't do anything. It's faithless. God can't change this situation. It's faithless. There's nothing that will help. I don't believe in the gospel. Nothing can transform this situation. I don't believe in the transformational work of the Word of God in the life of the believer. That's actually what we're saying by not dealing with conflict. Not only are we not glorifying God, we're not learning the first lesson of what is this law. What does this look like? What does heart idolatry look like? Does this make sense to you? You see, now I wonder if there's any questions about this, because I want to pause here, and I know there's a microphone and there's a couple of guys who can pass it around and make sure that if you have a question. Because I want us to pause here and slow down just a little bit, because I want you to get this. Who's going to pass the mic? Who's up? Okay. Thank you, sir. What's your name?
James.
Hey, James. Thank you. You got a great name. Thanks. You didn't write that thing. No.
Yeah.
Any questions about what we've said today? It can be about the text. It can be about the progression. Anything clarity-wise? Yes, ma'am.
I'll share something this last couple of weeks. This is what happened to me.
Okay.
I was first in watching a conflict in someone's life. It was very draining. And then it became between myself and another person in ministry. And God brought clarity into my heart, and he showed me, which broke my heart, because I had disappointed him.
Yeah.
And it was that I wanted to be in control, and what I wanted was to be a leader ahead of this other person, and that I had a selfish heart. And that just blew me away.
Yeah.
Until But I knew he would raise me up again with his gentleness, his grace, his mercy.
Sure.
And he brought it full circle. But it was painful to, and he's done it before, to open the eyes of my own heart.
Yeah.
But that's how he changes us when we're broken.
Good. You know, I really appreciate that very much, because the I desire and the I demand is in that. I don't know if you heard it or not, but it's there. And I think, again, the tool, if you'll use the tool to say, so what do I want? And how has it elevated to a level of a demand? And you know, when I looked at Thomas and said, what do you think I expect of you? This is resultant conversations. You know, what do you think I expect of you? I mean, he had stuff on the list that I didn't know he thought I expected. But you know where he got it from? He got it from me. You know? I mean, there are times when we don't realize, we don't understand just how much we influence the other person. And sometimes it's good influence, and sometimes it's idolatrous influence. But we have to name it. Yeah. Any other question that you have? I'm going to show you another slide in just a second, but go ahead and go back. Yes, sir. Thank you.
So if you're in a position where you're being asked to be, to use the word discerning of someone around you, whether you're in a leadership position or parenting is the other thing that came up that we've bounced back and forth, I am to have expectations of my children, I am to have expectations of my employees or those I supervise in ministry. How do I approach, how do I determine if something that I see is something that I legitimately need to approach as somebody who's in a position of leadership, or something that I'm creating out of my own idolatry?
Good. I really appreciate this question, because it's a tension, isn't it, between what I expect and how I expect unreasonably, or I over-expect. And it's a tension. Because should we have expectations of each other? Say yes. Yes. Can they be idolatrous? Yes. Can they be idolatrous at any moment? Yes. So it's a tension. We have to be careful. I can expect of my children certain things and end up elevating those to the level of demand, to the level of punishment. When I get, and I think the key here is this, is the next stage down, I judge. I think the key here is when I have a judgmental attitude or a judgment about this person, and I'll use a metaphor, I've locked them up in this box. I've put them in this box. They can't get out of the box because I know what I think about them. I have become idolatrous. I judge. And especially, hear me now, if I am not willing to discuss that with the person. Because if I don't discuss my judgment with that person, they have no way of getting out of the box. No way. They are locked up in my box of judgment. I am in trouble with Jesus. Do not judge. That's why he says, don't judge. Even the distinguishing, he's using a term that doesn't mean moral implication. That's no moral implication about it. And he's saying, don't do it. Because every time I do it, I judge. Every time I do it, it will turn, and hear me now, it will turn either into condemnation, I lock them up and don't let them out, or it will turn into discernment. I have the discussion with them, and I help them out. And it's to be one or the other. And discernment is something he applauds. But if I think that I can just hold this thing as true, this person is in this box, I don't think they're ever going to change, and not have the discussion with them, to think that I can do that and it not become condemning toward them, I'm kidding myself. As a matter of fact, as soon as I have that view, I have an assignment. Conflict is an assignment. It's not just an opportunity. It is an assignment. Then you will see clearly to get the speck out of your brother's eye. Jesus absolutely anticipates that you are going to go have the conversation with that person, help them understand what their speck is, and help them get the speck out of their eye. He absolutely expects that. Matter of fact, he wants that for us. It's Christian ministry. It's discipleship. Isn't it? It is. It's all of that. But when we refuse because we've been hurt so badly, or we just know how right we are, or we've got them in their box, they're never going to change. Who cares? They left anyhow, so good. Had an associate pastor in Florida, very large church. We were on the phone one day. Someone had recommended, an attorney had recommended we talk. And he says, Paul, listen, Our problem left 2 weeks ago. Those were his words to me. Now, I'll tell you what they meant. We fired the dude. That's not what he said, but that's what he meant. Now, this is a church of about 2,200, 2,500, something like that. 6 months later, I don't remember the right number now. I think it's 400. 400 people had left that church because of that conflict. But we don't have a problem. Our problem left 2 weeks ago. A year later, there's turmoil in the staff. Now there's fears. Are we going to get fired? You see? It just builds. It never ends. That's why you can't just go out and administratively or organizationally hammer the conflict. That's what Jesus didn't even talk about that. He didn't say that at all. And by the way, this passage in Matthew 7 has everything to do with business, it has everything to do with church, has everything to do with family, has everything to do with school relationships, everything to do with the playground, everything to do with the back fence, everything to do with marriage. He didn't give any restrictions to it. It applies to every relationship you have, no matter what the relationship is. Legal relationships, all of the above. I'm not an attorney. I can't really speak from that perspective. If Dave Schlachter was here, my ministry partner, he is an attorney, and he will tell you that. He says, man, the emptiness of the legal system is amazing. And the power of the gospel in the middle of the legal system can be powerful. Powerful. Do y'all know the store Hobby Lobby? Okay. Dave, we had a relationship with Hobby Lobby over the past few years. The owner of Hobby Lobby is a very fine Christian man, very good supporter of our ministry. And they were trying to determine, so how do we resolve conflict in our organization? They have 18,000 employees or some crazy number, a bunch of people around the country. And so they had Dave come in and say, what do we do with these organizational conflicts? And Dave has actually constructed a workplace application of these principles so that just in the workplace they can be applied. Because there's Christians and non-Christians employed at Hobby Lobby. And so he worked for a couple of years with the executives of Hobby Lobby and the upper management of Hobby Lobby applying these principles and attempting to put biblical peacemaking principles in play in the life of their business. That's an application. It's just, it's fair. It's happening in schools. There are public schools, and I wish I could remember exactly where this last one was that we just talked about. I don't remember. But there are public schools who are actually taking these principles and applying them in the classroom in their public schools. And they're good. I mean, they transfer. Common grace is one of the ways it's said, right, in theology. Very, very much applicable there, you know.
And I have the mic, so I'm going to ask one more question.
Please, sir.
When we've talked about Matthew 7, and we've talked about the idea that you should deal with the log in your own eye before dealing with the speck in theirs, in conversation, and it's hard to, and I guess I would ask you what you would say, that has been extended to say that I'm not Christ, I'm not sinless, there's never going to be a point where my eye is clear enough that I can try to remove the speck from yours.
Yes.
How do we respond to that question?
Ah, you guys are asking great questions, man. I really appreciate that because it shows the sensitivity that's necessary to get the speck out of the brother's eye.
Yeah, but what if you're not a Christian?
Well, let me answer this question first, yeah. Okay? Hang on. Because if you just go in and say, hey, dude, I got my log. Let me tell you about your speck. I'll dig that thing out of here in 5 minutes. I mean, that's arrogant, isn't it? Say yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you know that was a Corinthians problem? 1 Corinthians 1 through 4 is the Apostle Paul's assessment of the Corinthian church. That's what it is. He's assessing the Corinthian church. At the middle of chapter 4, verse 6, he uses the word arrogant the first time. He uses it two more times in 1 Corinthians 4 and then in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 2. And he takes them in a progression to say, you know, I hope none of you are arrogant, all the way to saying, you have become arrogant. He literally makes the case that arrogance is their heart idol. Did you know churches can have heart idols? Who's the church? It's us, isn't it? And we become idolatrous. We become demanding of our desires and expectational and disappointed and punishing and all of the above, judgmental, because of how we were, you know? And so I think the answer to your question is It's that old phrase. Now, this isn't news. This isn't new, right? It's the escalator. Remember the broken escalator thing? None of this is new, right? It's not. We just need to apply it, and we need to apply it progressively, I would say. But it's the old thing of, it's the attitude of one beggar showing another beggar where he found some bread. You know? If I go up to the person and say, man, I see something that I think is harmful to you, I think it's harmful to the kingdom, somewhere in between, can I have the privilege of identifying what I see? And then can we talk about it? Can we do that? Would you allow me the privilege of that? Now we got a chance to have a really good conversation. I think we need to ask permission. This is part of the answer. I think we need to know that we have the trust with that person, that they would trust us to tell them the truth. Know we care for them. That's part of trust. Know that we can actually help them. I mean, there are times when I've seen something in a person's life and I have that trust relationship and I say, you know, I need to point something out and I mean it for your best. I mean it for your good. But I'm telling you, I don't know what to do about it because I just don't have the goods in that area. And I'm identifying it for you to own it and to figure out who can help you with it. I'll help you identify that person if I can, but we really shouldn't even discuss it because I can't help you. I don't know how. And then I identify it for them and try to resource them, you know, to go deal with it. See, when we get to the third G, the common question of the third G, gently restore, is this. If someone were to come to you and say to you that they want to tell you something that's hard to hear, but you believe that they have your best in mind, would you listen to them? Absolutely. You know, that's that heart. It's not the condescending, you got a problem. When you say you've judged. You have a problem. That is a judgment. Now, is it condemning or is it discerning? Don't know yet, but it's a judgment. Crino. Just pure judgment. No moral implications. Not right or wrong. You may be totally right in what you say. You got a problem and you identify what it is. You know, when we talked to Thomas about the thing that Jen had mentioned, it was real. It wasn't condemnation. You know, that wasn't what was happening. My heart idolatry came out of me. It had nothing to do with Thomas. You know, that was my story. That was what I needed to learn. That's where I was able to grow. And that's what I'm saying in this second G area. You've got this huge opportunity to become more like Christ, to understand your heart, if you'll dive into this and say, okay, Lord, I'm going to pause and first look at this. Culturally, if you do it as a congregation, and if you learn how to do it, now that's another story, it's another thing we can talk about. How do you identify heart idols? This pathway of the progression of idols is just a tool to be able to start saying, so should I want that? How does that demand? What does that demand mean? Am I being an ogre, or am I having a demand that really is a biblical expectation that all of us should match up to? You know, because I mean, I expected Thomas to be pure in his walk. You know, I mean, I should expect him to be pure in his walk, and I did. But what does that mean? Is it fueling my demand? That makes it idolatrous. Okay. I want to show you one more thing real quick, and then we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back here in a few minutes. Go to, on my slides, it's number 26, Nathaniel. It's got a brown background. It's the first one with a brown gold background. Starts, why idols, they motivate us. Yeah, good. Okay. Pop up the four bullet points on this. I just want you to take a look at these four bullet points real quick, and the picture is worth 1,000 words, isn't it? we got a little bit of a problem there. There's going to be two more clicks. One of them is going to circle the top one, I believe, and then one's going to circle the bottom one. Yeah, you have to go back. Let me tell you what that last one says. It says, and therefore we have an idol in our heart. Okay? That's that last one. And therefore we have an idol in our heart. Why idols? Anytime we sin, something other than the true God is ruling our heart. So we are violating the first commandment, and therefore there is an idol in our heart. You with me? Now go to the next slide. Now, this slide is a highly animated one. Just hit it once. I think it's once, and it'll start. Yeah. Don't hit it again yet. I want you to look at these things. Here's the heart, and here are all of these entry gates to the heart. These things that are the outside circle are not the idol. These things that are the outside circle are the way I get into what the idol might be. You with me? Anger, for example, that I've mentioned many times today. See a lot of it. That's part of the reason that I mentioned it. But anger is an example of this. I'm angry about something. It doesn't mean I have an idol of anger. I don't think anger is an idol. No different than gossip is an idol, or envy is an idol, or laziness is an idol. Those are entry gates to what the idol actually is, to how we come to language the idol, how we come to be able to say, here is what my log is. Like when Jesus says, first get the log out of your own eye, how do you get it out if you don't know what it is? You don't know what you're looking for, especially in the heart. It's not like it's a part of the, you know, the back of your hand and you can look at all of it and say, oh, it's a part of the bone or it's part of the vessels or whatever, you know. It's not like that. It's inside. You can't see it. And it's deceptive, by the way. Remember? The heart is deceitfully wicked. Who can know it? I have to admit, I can't know it. So to language, it's not easy. It's not that hard. So we end up, now hit the slide again. We end up putting these three areas where idols seem to show up, or where the language of what the idol is can be actually identified and named. We come to this opportunity to be able to say, here is what this looks like. Now, go ahead and go to the next slide. It's going to be animated too, and just go ahead and pop through. Under misplaced trust, it has just two bullet points, so that'll help you not go past it maybe. Yeah, one more. Okay. So you can look at this now, and you can look at some of the dynamics of, so what am I looking at idols? How do I determine what kind of idol do I have? Fear, anxiety, worry, you know, desperation. I am afraid that. When a person says, I am afraid that, they're telling you where their idol might be. You're telling yourself where your idol might be. Or, all I want is... Do you ever believe it when a person says, all I want is, that's really all they want? It's just not the truth, is it? No, it means something. It indicates something. It's the language of idolatry, if you want, how these desires grow into a demand. Misplaced trust. You know, I mean, pride, condescending, judgmental attitude. You know, I think that you. You know, when I mean, listen, every time I have a thought about another person, and I categorize them, I am judging. I am in crino. What I do with that makes it condemnation or discernment. If I use it against them, and I'll give you an example of using it, I think that you are arrogant, so I am not going to fight that battle and talk to you. You're just arrogant. That's condemnation. That's judgment. I'm not even talking to the person. But I'm still judging them because I'm using it against them. I have them in a sin, and I don't let them out. I have them in something that is offensive to God, and I don't give them the gospel. I don't give them a way out. That is condemnation. It's not just I am this vehement, vile, condemning person. And a lot of people say, I don't condemn anybody. One lady in my second church, I never will forget it, she walked to me and she goes, Pastor Paul, you know I love everybody. You know why she came up and told me that? Because everybody's telling her all kinds of stuff that didn't demonstrate that statement. I mean, she had all kinds of challenges going on. I mean, this judgment and this condemning, this setting aside, this categorizing, this not being brothers and sisters in Christ, you know, not taking biblical responsibilities the way I would say it, demonstrates that judgment. You with me? As opposed to discernment. Discernment means something happens. Discernment means I want to use this for your good. Man, there's something you need to learn. Can we talk about it? Can I help you with it? You know? And I know, I mean, listen, when I do this work, there is never a time when I do a mediation where God's not talking to me about my own heart too. Now, the parties don't necessarily know it. I don't talk about it. It'd be inappropriate even to talk about it and a change of subject because I'm trying to assist them. But I don't help people, and I do hundreds of mediations every year. I don't help people in mediations when God doesn't talk to me about my heart. You with me? this opportunity. So if I'm categorizing, setting them aside, it's idolatry. I think that you, I mean, when we do that, we may just be at Crino. We may just be at having this determination of the distinguishing factor in the life of a person, and we haven't done anything with it yet. I don't think you can stay there long. That's why Jesus says, don't do it. I don't think you can stay there long where you don't either go toward condemnation or toward discernment. One or the other, you have to move toward. You have to. You with me? But you have to pause to understand your heart. You have to pause to do that. You have to be patient. Last thing, then we'll take a break. One of my life lessons in doing mediations, when I first started doing mediations in the year 2000, I started knowing what people's idols were. I mean, I knew it pretty quick. And I'm sitting there going, are you a thief? You know? I didn't say this to him now, don't get me wrong. Are you not? What are you? I mean, can you not see this? It's really plain to me. And I had this urgency to tell them. I'm a preacher now. I tell people all the time, right? I'm trained to tell. And I have this thing I want to tell. I learned real quickly that people don't want you to tell. And so I said, Lord, what? You know, and then I learned something, because we would progress. I wouldn't do anything. We would progress through the conversation and through the mediation, and it turned out their heart idol was identified, and it was different than what I had initially thought. I was wrong. If I had told them, I would have been wrong. Here's the learning. Patience is when the power of God shows up. Patience is where God works. It is a place. It's where He works. When I urgently move to the person, I'm not giving God the chance to work. When I pause to believe that nothing is happening in the other party is a misnomer. It's a disbelief. Because God is always working in the other party, just as He's always working in me. When I pause here, I have to express patience about that person and about what they're doing. Does that make sense? And I'm telling you, God works in that time. It's amazing. I could give you illustrations, and I'm really tempted to do that, but I won't do that because I know we need to take a break. You've been really patient and very attentive, and I appreciate that very much. May the Lord take what we've talked about and use it for your benefit and mine as we grow to be more like Christ. Let's take a 10, 15-minute break, something like that. Is that good, Pastor? And then we'll come back. We'll call you back together in a few minutes, okay? God bless you.